time, handed him the note and explained that Dr. Pyotr Dmitrich, how great and important this Pyotr Dmitrich, formerly so insignificant, now appeared to Levin, had promised to come at any time, and that he would certainly not be angry, and must therefore be called at once. The footman consented and went upstairs, asking Levin to step into the waiting room. Levin could hear the doctor at the other side of the door, coughing, walking about, washing, and speaking. Some 3 minutes elapsed. To Levin they seemed more than an hour. He could not wait any longer. "Pyotr Dmitrich! Pyotr Dmitrich!" he called out in a tone of entreaty through the open door.
"For heaven's sake, forgive me. Receive me as you are. It's over 2 hours."
"Immediately, immediately," answered a voice, and Levin was astounded to detect that the doctor was smiling as he said it.
"Just for one moment."
"Immediately." 2 minutes more passed while the doctor put on his boots, and 2 more while he put on his clothes and brushed his hair.
"Pyotr Dmitrich,"
Levin again began in a piteous voice. But at that instant the doctor came out, dressed and with his hair brushed. "These people have no conscience," thought Levin, "brushing their hair while we are perishing." "Good morning," said the doctor, holding out his hand, and, as it seemed to Levin, teasing him by his calm manner. "Don't hurry." "Well?" Trying to be as exact as possible, Levin began recounting every unnecessary detail of his wife's position, continually interrupting himself to beg the doctor to accompany him at once.
"Don't be in such a hurry. You see, you are inexperienced. I'm sure I shall not be needed. But I promised, and if you like, I will come. But there is no hurry. Please, sit down. Won't you have a cup of coffee?"
Levin gave the doctor a look which asked whether he was not laughing at him. But the doctor had no idea of laughing. "I know, I know," he said with a smile. "I am a family man myself. We husbands are the most miserable of creatures at those times. I have a patient whose husband always runs away into the stable on such occasions.
But what is your opinion, Pyotr Dmitrich? Do you think it may go all right?"
"All the symptoms are favourable."
"Then you will come at once?" said Levin, looking angrily at the servant who brought in the coffee.
"In an hour's time."
"No, for heaven's sake—"
"Well, only let me finish my coffee." The doctor began on his coffee. Both kept silence.
"Well, the Turks are being seriously beaten. Did you read yesterday's telegram?" asked the doctor, chewing a piece of roll.
"No, I can't stand it," said Levin, jumping up. "So, you will come in a quarter of an hour?"
"In half an hour."
"On your honour?"
Levin got home just as the princess arrived, and they met at the bedroom door. There were tears in the princess's eyes, and her hands shook. When she saw Levin, she embraced him and began to cry.
"Well, Maria Vlasyevna, darling?" she asked,
seizing the hand of the midwife, who came toward them with a beaming but preoccupied expression.
"It's going all right," she said. "Persuade her to lie down. It will be easier for her."
From the moment when he woke up and understood what was the matter, Levin had braced himself to endure what might await him without reasoning and without anticipating anything, firmly suppressing all his thoughts and feelings, determined not to upset his wife, but on the contrary to calm and support her. Not allowing himself even to think of what was about to happen and how it would end, judging by inquiries he had made as to the time such affairs usually lasted, Levin mentally prepared himself to endure and to keep his heart under restraint for something like 5 hours, which seemed to him within his power. But when he returned from the doctor's and again saw her sufferings, he began repeating more and more often, "God pardon and help us," sighing and lifting his head, afraid lest he should not be able to bear the strain and should either burst into tears or run away, so tormenting was it for him. And only 1 hour had passed. But after that hour, another passed, a second, a third, and all the 5 hours that he had set himself as the longest term of possible endurance, and still the situation was unchanged. And he went on enduring, for there was nothing else to do but to endure, thinking every moment that he had reached the utmost limit of endurance, and that in a moment his heart would burst with pity. But the minutes went by, and the hours, and other hours, and his suffering and terror and strain grew tenser. The ordinary conditions of life, without which nothing can be imagined, no longer existed for Lievin. He lost the sense of time. Sometimes minutes, those minutes when she called him to her and he held her moist hand, now pressing his with extraordinary strength and now pushing him away, seemed to him like hours, and then again hours seemed but minutes. He was surprised when Marya Vlasyevna asked him to light a candle behind the partition, and he learnt that it was already 5 o'clock in the evening. Had he been told it was 10 in the morning, he would not have been more astonished. He had just as little idea of where he was at that time as he had of when it all took place. He saw her burning face, now bewildered and full of suffering, and now smiling and soothing him. He saw the princess, red, overwrought, her grey hair out of curl, and with tears which she energetically swallowed, biting her lips. He saw Dolly. He saw the doctor smoking thick cigarettes, and Marya Vlasyevna with a firm, resolute and tranquilizing look on her face, and the old prince pacing up and down the ballroom and frowning. But he did not know how they came and went, nor where they were. The princess was one moment in the bedroom with the doctor, and the next in the study, where a table laid for a meal had made its appearance. And next it was not the princess, but Dolly. Afterwards Lievin remembered being sent somewhere. Once he was told to fetch a table and a sofa. He did it with zeal, believing that it was necessary for her sake, and only later discovered that he had been preparing a sleeping place for himself. Then he was sent to the study to ask the doctor about something. The doctor answered him, and then began talking about the scenes in the city Duma. Then he was sent to fetch an icon with silver gilt mounts from the princess's bedroom, and he and the princess's old lady's maid climbed on a cupboard to get down the icon, and he broke the little lamp that burnt before it, and the old servant tried to comfort him about his wife and about the lamp. He brought the icon back with him and put it at the head of Kitty's bed, carefully pushing it in behind the pillows. But where, when, and why all this was done, he did not know. Nor did he understand why the princess took his hand and, looking pitifully at him, entreated him to be calm, nor why Dolly tried to persuade him to eat something and led him out of the room, nor why even the doctor looked seriously and sympathizingly at him, offering him some drops. He only knew and felt that what was happening was similar to what had happened the year before in the hotel of the provincial town, on the deathbed of his brother Nikolai. Only that was sorrow, and this was joy. But that sorrow and this joy were equally beyond the usual conditions of life. They were like openings in that usual life through which something higher became visible. And, as in that case, what was now being accomplished came harshly, painfully, incomprehensibly. And while watching it, the soul soared, as then, to heights it had never known before, at which reason could not keep up with it.
"Lord, pardon and help us,"
he kept repeating incessantly to himself, appealing to God, in spite of a long period of apparently complete estrangement, just as trustingly and simply as in the days of childhood and early youth. During the whole of that time he was alternately in two different moods. One mood when not in her presence, when with the doctor, who smoked one thick cigarette after another and extinguished them against the rim of the overflowing ashpan, when with Dolly and the prince, where they talked about dinner, politics, or Maria Petrovna's illness, and when Levin suddenly quite forgot for an instant what was happening and felt just as if he was waking up. And the other was in her presence, by her pillow, where his heart was ready to burst with pity and yet did not burst. And there he prayed unceasingly to God. And every time when the screams that came from the bedroom roused him from momentary forgetfulness, he succumbed to the same strange error that had possessed him in the first moments. Every time, on hearing the scream, he jumped up and ran to justify himself, but recollected on the way that he was not to blame and that he longed to protect and help her. But when, looking at her, he again saw that to help was impossible, he was seized with horror and said, "Lord, pardon and help us," and the longer it lasted, the stronger grew both his moods. Out of her presence he became calmer, quite forgetting her, and at the same time both her sufferings and his feeling of the impossibility of helping her became more and more poignant. He would jump up, wishing to run away somewhere, but ran to her instead. Sometimes, when she had called him again and again, he was half inclined to blame her. But seeing her meek, smiling face and hearing her say, "I have worn you out," he blamed God. But the thought of God made him at once pray for forgiveness and mercy. Chapter 15. He did not know whether it was late or early. The candles were all burning low. Dolly had just entered the study and suggested that the doctor should lie down. Levin sat listening to the doctor's stories of a quack magnetizer and staring at the ash of the doctor's cigarette. It was an interval of rest and oblivion. He had quite forgotten what was going on. He listened to the doctor's tale and understood it. Suddenly there was a scream unlike anything he had ever heard. The scream was so terrible that Levin did not even jump up, but looked breathlessly with a frightened and inquiring glance at the doctor, who bent his head on one side to listen and smiled approvingly. Everything was so out of the ordinary that nothing any longer surprised Levin. "Probably it had to be so," thought he, and remained sitting still. "But who was it screaming?" He jumped up and rushed into the bedroom on tiptoe, past Maria Vlasyevna and the princess, and stopped at his place at the head of the bed. The screaming had ceased, but there was a change. What it was he could not make out or understand, nor did he want to understand it, but he read it in Maria Vlasyevna's face. She looked pale and stern, and as resolute as before, though her jaw trembled a little, and her eyes were fixed intently on Kitty. Kitty's burning face, worn with suffering, with a lock of hair clinging to her clammy forehead, was turned toward him, trying to catch his eye. Her raised hands asked for his. Seizing his cold hands in her perspiring ones, she pressed them to her face.
"Don't go, don't go. I am not afraid, I am not afraid," she said rapidly. "Mama, take off my earrings, they're in the way. You are not afraid? Soon, Maria Vlasyevna, soon."
She spoke very rapidly and tried to smile. But all at once her face became distorted and she pushed him away.
"No, this is awful. I shall die. Die. Go. Go,"
she cried. And again he heard that scream unlike any other cry. Levin clasped his head in his hands and ran out of the room. "It's all right. It's all right. All goes well," Dolly called after him. But say what they might, he knew that now all was lost. Leaning his head against the doorpost, he stood in the next room and heard someone shrieking and moaning in a way he had never heard till then, and he knew that these sounds were produced by what once was Kitty. He had long ceased wishing for a child, and now he hated that child. He did not now even wish her to live, but only longed that these terrible sufferings should end.
"Doctor, what is it? What is it? Oh, my God!"
he cried, grasping the hand of the doctor who had just entered. "It's coming to an end," said the doctor, with a face so serious that Lievin thought that end meant death. Quite beside himself, he rushed into her room. The first thing he saw was Marya Vlasyevna's face. It was still more frowning and stern. Kitty's face did not exist. In its place was something terrible, both because of its strained expression and because of the sounds which proceeded from it. He let his head drop upon the wood of the bedstead, feeling that his heart was breaking. The terrible screaming did not cease, but grew yet more awful until, as if it had reached the utmost limit of horror, it suddenly ceased. Lievin could scarcely believe his ears, but there was no room for doubt. The screaming had ceased, and he heard a sound of movement, of rustling, of accelerated breathing, and her voice, faltering, living, tender, and happy, as it said, "It's over." He raised his head. With her arms helplessly outstretched upon the quilt, unusually beautiful and calm, she lay gazing silently at him, trying unsuccessfully to smile. And suddenly, out of the mysterious, terrible, and unearthly world in which he had been living for the last 22 hours, Lievin felt himself instantaneously transported back to the old, everyday world. But now, radiant with the light of such new joy that it was insupportable. The taut strings snapped, and sobs and tears of joy that he had not in the least anticipated arose within him, with such force that they shook his whole body and long prevented his speaking. Falling on his knees by her bedside, he held his wife's hand to his lips, kissing it, and that hand, by a feeble movement of the fingers, replied to the kisses. And meanwhile, at the foot of the bed, like a flame above a lamp, flickered in Marya Vlasyevna's skilful hands the life of a human being who had never before existed, a human being who, with the same right and the same importance to himself, would live and would procreate others like himself.
"Alive! Alive! And a boy! Don't be anxious," Lievin heard Marya Vlasyevna say as she slapped the baby's back with a shaking hand. "Mama, is it true?" asked Kitty.
The princess could only sob in reply. And amid the silence, as a positive answer to the mother's question, a voice quite unlike all the restrained voices that had been speaking in the room made itself heard. It was a bold, insolent voice that had no consideration for anything. It was the cry of the new human being who had so incomprehensibly appeared from some unknown realm. Before that, if Lievin had been told that Kitty was dead and that he had died with her, that they had angel children and that God was there present with them, he would not have been astonished. But now, having returned to the world of actuality, he had to make great efforts to understand that she was alive and well, and that the creature that was yelling so desperately was his son. Kitty was alive, her sufferings were over, and he was full of unspeakable bliss. This he comprehended, and it rendered him entirely happy. But the child? Whence and why had he come? Who was he? He could not at all accustom himself to the idea. It seemed something superfluous, something overflowing, and for a long time he was unable to get used to it. Chapter 16. Toward 10 o'clock, the old prince, Koznishev, and Oblonsky were with Levin, and having talked about the young mother, they had begun discussing other matters. Levin listened to them, and at the same time involuntarily thought of the past and of what had been going on before that morning, remembering himself as he had been yesterday before this event. 100 years seemed to have elapsed since then. He felt as if he were on some unattainable height, from which he painstakingly descended in order not to hurt the feelings of those with whom he was conversing. He talked, but never ceased thinking of his wife, of the details of her present condition, and of his son, to the idea of whose existence he painstakingly tried to accustom himself. That feminine world, which, since his marriage, had received a new and unsuspected significance for him, now rose so high in his estimation that his imagination could not grasp it. He heard a conversation about yesterday's dinner at the club and thought, "What is happening to her now? Is she asleep? How is she? What is she thinking about? Is our son, Dmitri, crying?" And in the middle of the conversation, in the middle of a phrase, he suddenly jumped up and left the room.
"Send and let me know whether I may see her," said the old prince.
"All right, directly," answered Levin, and without pausing went to her room. She was not asleep, but was talking quietly with her mother, making plans for the christening. Made neat, her hair brushed, a smart cap trimmed with something blue on her head, she lay on her back with her arms outside the quilt, and met his look with a look which drew him toward her. That look, already bright, grew still brighter as he approached. On her face was the same change from the earthly to that which was beyond earth, as is seen on the faces of the dead. But in their case it is a farewell. In hers it was a welcome. Again an agitation, similar to that which he had felt at the moment of the birth, gripped his heart. She took his hand and asked whether he had slept. He could not answer, and, conscious of his weakness, turned away.
"And I have been dozing, Kostya," she said, "and now I feel so comfortable."
She was gazing at him, but suddenly her face changed.
"Let me have him," said she, hearing the baby's cry. "Let me have him, Marya Vasyevna, and he will see him too."
"Well then, we'll let Papa have a look," said Marya Vlasyevna, lifting something red, strange and quivering, and bringing it nearer.
"But wait a bit, let's first get dressed."
And Marya Vlasyevna put the quivering red object on the bed and began unwrapping it, and then swaddling it again, raising and turning it with one finger, and powdering it with something. Levin, gazing at this tiny, piteous being, vainly searched his soul for some indications of paternal feeling. He felt nothing for it but repulsion. But when it was stripped and he caught a glimpse of thin little arms and legs, saffron-coloured, but with fingers and toes, and even with thumbs distinguishable from the rest, and when he saw how, as though they were soft springs, Marya Vlasyevna bent those little arms which stuck up and encased them in linen garments, he was so filled with pity for that being, and so alarmed lest she should hurt it, that he tried to restrain her hand. Marya Vlasyevna laughed.
"Don't be afraid! Don't be afraid!"
When the baby had been swaddled and made into a firm doll, Marya Vlasyevna turned it over as if proud of her work, and stepped aside that Levin might see his son in all his beauty. Kitty turned her eyes and gazed fixedly in the same direction. "Let me have him, let me have him," she said, and was even going to raise herself.
"What are you doing, Katerina Alexandrovna? You must not move like that. Wait a moment, I'll give him to you. Let's show Papa what a fine fellow we are."
And Marya Vlasyevna held out to Levin on one hand, the other merely supporting the nape of the shaky head, this strange, limp, red creature that hid its head in its swaddling clothes. But there was also a nose, blinking eyes, and smacking lips.
"A beautiful baby," said Marya Vlasyevna.
Levin sighed bitterly. This beautiful baby only inspired him with a sense of repulsion and pity. These were not at all the feelings he had expected. He turned away while Marya Vlasyevna laid the child to the unaccustomed breast. Suddenly a laugh made him lift his head. It was Kitty laughing. The baby had taken the breast.
"Well, that's enough, that's enough," said Marya Vlasyevna,
but Kitty would not part with the baby. He fell asleep in her arms.
"Now look at him,"
said Kitty, turning him so that Levin could see him. The odd-looking little face wrinkled up still more, and the baby sneezed. Smiling, and hardly able to keep back tears of tenderness, Levin kissed his wife and quitted the darkened room. What he felt toward this little creature was not at all what he had anticipated. There was nothing merry or joyful in it. On the contrary, there was a new and distressing sense of fear. It was the consciousness of another vulnerable region. And this consciousness was at first so painful, the fear lest that helpless being should suffer was so strong, that it quite hid the strange feeling of unreasoning joy and even pride which he experienced when the baby sneezed.
Chapter 17.
Oblonsky's affairs were in a bad state. Two-thirds of the money for the forest had already been spent, and by allowing a discount of 10%, he had obtained from the merchant almost the whole of the last third. But the latter would not advance any more of the money, especially as Dolly, who had that winter for the first time plainly claimed a right to her own property, had refused to endorse the contract with a receipt for the last third of the payment. Oblonsky's whole salary went for household expenses and the liquidation of small, pressing bills. He had no money at all. This was unpleasant, inconvenient, and in Oblonsky's opinion ought not to continue. The cause, as he understood it, was that he received too small a salary. The position had certainly been a very good one a few years ago, but it was so no longer. Petrov, the bank director, got 12,000 rubles. Sventitsky, director of a company, got 17,000 rubles, and Mitin, having founded a bank, got 50,000 rubles. "Evidently I have been asleep and have been forgotten," thought Oblonsky. And he began pricking up his ears and looking around, and by the end of the winter he had discovered a very good post and begun an attack on it, first from Moscow through aunts, uncles and friends, and then in the spring, when the matter had ripened, he himself went to Petersburg. This post was one of those, now far more numerous than formerly, carrying salaries from 1,000 to 50,000 rubles a year, soft, profitable jobs. It was a membership of the committee of the joint agency of the mutual credit balance of southern railways and banking houses. Like all such posts, it required such immense knowledge and activity as could hardly be united in one man. And as there was no one found who united those qualities, it was at any rate better for the post to be filled by an honest rather than a dishonest man. Oblonsky was not only an honest man, placing no special emphasis on the word, but he was an honest man with an emphasis, in the special sense attaching to the word in Moscow, where they say, an honest worker, an honest writer, an honest journalist, an honest institution, an honest tendency, meaning not only that the man or the institution are not dishonest, but also that they are capable on occasion of being objectionable to the government.
Oblonsky moved in those Moscow circles where that word was used, and was there considered an honest man, so that he had a better claim to the post than other people. The post carried a salary of from 7 to 10,000 rubles a year, and Oblonsky could hold it without resigning his official position. It depended on 2 ministers, 1 lady, and 2 Jews. And though they had already been prepared, it was necessary for Oblonsky to see all these people in Petersburg. Moreover, he had promised his sister Anna to obtain a decisive answer about the divorce from Karenin. So, having got 50 rubles from Dolly, he went to Petersburg. Sitting in Karenin's study and listening to his article on the causes of the bad state of Russian finance, Oblonsky only waited for him to conclude to speak about his own affairs and about Anna. "Yes, it is very true," Oblonsky agreed, when Karenin, taking off the pince-nez without which he could no longer read, looked up inquiringly at his former brother-in-law. "It is very true in detail, but all the same the principle of today is freedom." "Yes, but I bring forward another principle which embraces the principle of freedom," said Karenin, accentuating the word "embraces," and putting his pince-nez on again to re-read the part where this was said. Turning over the beautifully written, very broad-margined manuscript, Karenin re-read the convincing passage. "I do not want protection for the benefit of private individuals, but for the common good, for the lowest and for the highest classes equally," he said, looking at Oblonsky over his pince-nez. "But they cannot understand this. They are concerned only with their private interests and are carried away by phrases." Oblonsky knew that when Karenin began talking about what they did and thought, they being those who did not wish to accept his projects and were the cause of all the evil in Russia, the end of the subject was near at hand, and he therefore willingly abandoned the principle of freedom and agreed entirely. Karenin was silent, thoughtfully turning over the leaves of his manuscript.
"Oh, by the way," said Oblonsky, "I wanted to ask you to take an opportunity when you see Pomorsky to put in a word for me, and to tell him that I should very much like to get the vacant post of member of the committee of the Joint Agency of the Mutual Credit Balance of Southern Railways."
The name of the post that was so near his heart was already familiar to Oblonsky, and he pronounced it rapidly without any blunder. Karenin inquired what was the work of this new committee, and pondered. He was considering whether in the activity of this committee there was not something at variance with his own projects. But as the work of the new institution was very complicated, and his project covered a very extensive domain, he could not decide this immediately, and taking off his pince-nez said, "Certainly I could speak to him, but really, why do you want the post?"
"The salary is good, up to 9,000, and my means..."
9,000? Repeated Karenin, and frowned. The large figure of the salary reminded him that, in that respect, the post Oblonsky was aspiring to was opposed to the main idea of his projects, which always tended toward economy. "I consider, and I have written an article on the point, that the enormous salaries paid nowadays are a symptom of the false economic position of our administration."
"Yes, but what would you have?" said Oblonsky. "Let's say a bank director gets 10,000. He's worth it, you know. Or an engineer gets 20,000. It's a live business, anyway."
"I consider that a salary is payment for value received and should be subject to the law of supply and demand. If that law is ignored when fixing a salary, as, for instance, when I see that of 2 engineers who have passed through the same institute and are equally well instructed and capable, one receives 40,000 and the other is satisfied with 2,000, or when lawyers or hussars who have no special knowledge are appointed directors of banks or companies and receive gigantic salaries, I conclude that these salaries are not fixed by the law of supply and demand, but by personal influence. This is an abuse, important in itself, which has a bad effect on the state service. I consider..." Oblonsky hastened to interrupt his brother-in-law.
"Yes," said he, "but you will agree that a new and unquestionably useful institution is being started. Anyway, it is a live business. It is particularly desired that the work should be managed honestly,
concluded Oblonsky, with an emphasis on the word. But the Moscow meaning of honest was unintelligible to Karenin. "Honesty is only a negative quality," said he. "But you would greatly oblige me, all the same, if you would put in a word, when you happen to see Pomorsky," said Oblonsky.
"But it depends chiefly on Bolgarinov, I think," said Karenin.
"Bolgarinov quite agrees as far as he is concerned," returned Oblonsky, with a blush. He blushed at the mention of Bolgarinov, because he had that morning been to see the Jew, and the visit had left an unpleasant impression on his mind. Oblonsky was firmly convinced that the business he wished to serve was new, alive, and honest. But that morning, when Bolgarinov, with obvious intention, made him wait 2 hours in his waiting-room with other petitioners, he had suddenly felt uncomfortable. Whether it was that he, Prince Oblonsky, a descendant of Rurik, was waiting 2 hours in a Jew's waiting-room, or that, for the first time in his life, he was departing from the example set by his ancestors of serving the state only and was entering on a new field, at any rate he felt uncomfortable. During those 2 hours in Bolgarinov's waiting-room, he had walked about, boldly, smoothing his whiskers, entering into conversation with other applicants, inventing a joke to tell of how he had waited at the Jews, carefully concealing his feelings from others, and even from himself. But all the time he felt uncomfortable and vexed, without knowing why. Was it that nothing would come of his pun, "I had business with a Jew, but could not get at him even to say adieu"? Adieu. Or was it something else? And when Bolgarinov at length received him with extreme politeness, evidently triumphing in his humiliation, and very nearly refused his request, Oblonsky hastened to forget it as quickly as he could, and only now, on recollecting it, blushed.
Chapter 18. "Now, there's another matter. You know what it is?" "About Anna," said Oblonsky, after a short pause, when he had shaken off the unpleasant recollection. Directly Oblonsky mentioned Anna's name, Karenin's face entirely changed. Instead of its former animation, it expressed weariness and lifelessness. "What is it you wish of me?" Karenin said, turning round in his chair and folding his pince-nez.
"A decision. Some decision, Alexei Alexandrovitch. I address myself to you not as—"
He was going to say, as an offended husband, but afraid of injuring his case thereby, he changed the expression to "not as a statesman." This sounded inappropriate, but simply as a man, a kind man, and a Christian. "You should have pity on her." "What do you mean exactly?" asked Karenin in a low tone.
"Why, pity her. If you had seen her as I have, who have spent the whole winter with her, you would pity her. Her position is awful, literally awful."
"It seems to me," returned Karenin in a more high-pitched, almost squeaky voice, "that Anna Arkadyevna has everything she herself desired."
"Oh, Alexei Alexandrovitch, for God's sake, don't let us have any recriminations. What is past is past. You know what she wants and is waiting for. The divorce."
"But I understood that Anna Arkadyevna declined a divorce if I insisted on keeping my son. I answered in that sense and thought the matter was closed. I consider it closed," shrieked Karenin.
"For heaven's sake, don't excite yourself," said Oblonsky, touching his brother-in-law's knee. "The matter is not closed. If you will let me recapitulate, this is how matters stood. When you parted, you were great, as magnanimous as a man can possibly be. You consented to everything, her freedom and even a divorce. She appreciated that. Yes, don't think otherwise. She really appreciated it. She appreciated it to such a degree that, at the moment, feeling herself to blame toward you, she did not consider and could not consider everything. She renounced everything. But facts and time have shown that her situation is tormenting and impossible."
"Anna Arkadyevna's life cannot interest me," interposed Karenin,
lifting his brows. "Allow me not to believe that," Oblonsky rejoined gently. "Her situation is tormenting to her and does not benefit anyone. She has deserved it, you may say. She knows that and does not ask you for anything. She says plainly that she dare not ask anything. But I, and all her relatives who all love her, beg and implore you. Why should she be so tormented? Who gains by it?"
"Excuse me, you seem to be placing me in the position of defendant," Karenin remonstrated.
"Oh, no, no, not at all. Understand me," said Oblonsky, now touching Karenin's hand, as if he was sure that the contact would soften his brother-in-law. "All I say is that her position is tormenting and could be made easier by you without any detriment to yourself. I would arrange everything for you so that you would not be bothered. You see, you promised."
"The promise was given before, and I thought the question about my son had settled the matter. Besides, I hoped that Anna Arkadyevna would have generosity enough,"
uttered Karenin with difficulty, his lips trembling and his face turning pale.
"She leaves everything to your generosity. She asks, she pleads for one thing only. Help her out of the intolerable position she is in. She no longer asks for her son."
"Alexei Alexandrovich, you are a good man. Enter for a moment into her situation. The question of a divorce is for her, in her position, one of life and death. If you had not promised before, she would have grown reconciled to her position and have gone on living in the country. But as you had promised, she wrote to you and moved to Moscow, and now in Moscow, where every time she meets anyone it is like a knife in her heart, she has been living for 6 months every day expecting your decision. Why, it's like keeping a man condemned to death with the halter round his neck for months, promising him either death or a reprieve. Have pity on her, and I undertake to arrange. Your scruples—"
"I am not speaking of that."
"Of that," Karenin interrupted him in a disgusted tone.
"But perhaps I promised something I had no right to promise."
"Then you refuse what you promised?"
"I have never refused to do what is possible. But I want time to consider in how far what was promised is possible."
"No, Alexei Alexandrovich," said Oblonsky, jumping to his feet. "I will not believe that. She is as wretched as a woman can be, and you cannot refuse such a—"
"As far as what I promised is possible.
Vous professez d'être un libre penseur, but I, as a believer in so important a matter, cannot act contrary to the Christian law. But in Christian communities, and in ours too, as far as I know, divorce is permitted," said Oblonsky. "Divorce is also permitted by our church. And we see—"
"It is permitted, but not in that sense."
"Alexei Alexandrovich, I don't recognize you," said Oblonsky, after a pause. "Was it not you, and did we not appreciate it, who forgave everything and, moved just by Christian feeling, were ready to sacrifice everything? You yourself said, 'Give your coat,' when they would take your cloak. And now—"
"I beg—" began Karenin in a shrill voice, suddenly rising to his feet, pale and with trembling jaw.
"I beg you to stop this conversation." "Oh, no. Well, then, forgive me. Forgive me if I have pained you," said Oblonsky with an embarrassed smile, holding out his hand. "I only delivered my message as an envoy."
Karenin gave him his hand, reflected, and then said,
"I must think it over and seek for guidance. The day after tomorrow,
I will give you a final answer, he added, after consideration. Chapter 19. Oblonsky was just leaving when Corneille entered and announced, Sergei Alexeyevich. Who is Sergei Alexeyevich? Oblonsky was about to ask, but immediately recollected.
Oh, Seretse, he said. Sergei Alexeyevich! Why, I thought it was the director of the department!
And he remembered that Anna had asked him to see the boy. He recalled the timid, pathetic look with which Anna, at parting from him, had said, Anyhow, you will see him. Find out everything. Where he is, who is with him. And, Stiva, if it is possible...
Isn't it possible?
He had understood what if it is possible meant. It meant, if it is possible to arrange the divorce so that she should have her son. But now Oblonsky saw that it was useless even to think of that. He was, however, glad to see his nephew. Karenin reminded his brother-in-law that they never mentioned his mother to the boy and asked him not to say a word about her. He was very ill after that unexpected interview with his mother, remarked Karenin. We even feared for his life. But sensible treatment and sea-bathing in the summer have restored his health, and now, on doctor's advice, I send him to school. The influence of his schoolfellows has really had a good effect on him, and he is quite well, and learns well.
Hallo! What a fine fellow! True enough, it's not little Seretse now, but a complete Sergei Alexeyevich, said Oblonsky, smiling as he looked at a handsome boy in a blue jacket and long trousers who entered the room boldly and confidently. The lad looked healthy and bright. He bowed to his uncle as to a stranger, but recognizing him, he blushed and turned away from him quickly, as if offended and angry about something. The boy came up to his father and handed him his school report.
Well, that's pretty good, said his father. You may go now.
He has grown thin and tall, and is no longer a child but a regular boy, said Oblonsky. I like it. Do you remember me?
The boy glanced swiftly at his father.
I do, mon oncle, he answered, looking at his uncle and then again lowering his eyes. His uncle called him nearer and took his hand.
Well, how are things?
Said he, wishing to start a conversation, but not knowing what to say. The boy, blushing and not answering, gently withdrew his hand from his uncle's grasp. As soon as Oblonsky released it, after a questioning glance at his father, he hastily left the room like a bird let out of its cage. A year had passed since Seretse last saw his mother. Since then he had not heard any more of her. During this year he had been sent to school, and had learnt to know his schoolmates and to like them. The dreams and memories of his mother, which, after their interview, had made him ill, no longer occupied him. When they rose in his memory, he took pains to drive them away, considering them shameful and fit only for girls, but not for a boy and a chum. He knew that his father and mother had had a quarrel which separated them, knew that it was his fate to remain with his father, and he tried to accustom himself to that thought. He felt uncomfortable at meeting his uncle, who resembled his mother, because it awakened those very memories which he considered shameful. It was the more disagreeable because from some words he had overheard while waiting outside the study door, and especially from his father's and uncle's faces, he guessed that they had been talking about his mother. And in order not to blame the father with whom he lived and upon whom he depended, and above all not to give way to the sensibility which he considered so degrading, Seretse tried not to look at that uncle, who had come to upset his peace of mind, and not to think of what was called to mind by the sight of him. But when Oblonsky, who had come out after him, saw him on the stairs, and called him and asked how he spent his time between lessons at school, Seretse, in his father's absence, got into conversation with him. "We play at railways now," he said, answering the question. "You see, it's this way. Two sit down on a form, they are passengers. One stands on the same form. The others all harness themselves to it. They may do it with their hands or their belts. And then off they go through all the rooms. The doors are opened beforehand.
It's not easy to be the guard.
That's the one who stands up? Asked Oblonsky with a smile.
Yes, it needs courage and quickness, especially if they stop suddenly, or if somebody falls down.
Yes, that's no joke, said Oblonsky,
looking sadly into those animated eyes so like the mother's, an infant's eyes no longer, and no longer altogether innocent. And, in spite of his promise to Karenin, he could not refrain from speaking of Anna.
Do you remember your mother? He suddenly asked.
No, I don't, hurriedly replied Tsaretsa, and blushing scarlet he hung down his head. His uncle could get nothing more out of him. Half an hour later the Slav tutor found his pupil on the stairs, and for a long while could not make out whether he was in a temper or was simply crying.
I expect you hurt yourself when you fell down, said the tutor. I told you it was a dangerous game. I shall have to tell your headmaster about it.
If I hadn't hurt myself, no one would have known it. That is quite certain.
Well then, what is it?
Leave me alone. If I do remember, or if I don't. What business is it of his? Why should I remember? Leave me alone,
he said, now addressing not his tutor, but the world in general. Chapter 20. As was his wont, Oblonsky did not spend his time idly while in Petersburg. Besides business, his sister's divorce, and his post, it was as usual necessary for him, as he said, to refresh himself in Petersburg after the mustiness of Moscow. Moscow, despite its café chantant and its omnibuses, was still a stagnant pool. Oblonsky always felt this. After living in Moscow, especially in the bosom of his family, Oblonsky always felt his spirits flag. When he had spent a long time in Moscow without a break, he reached a state in which he began to be upset by his wife's ill-humour and reproaches, by the health and education of the children, and the petty details of his work. Even the fact that he was in debt worried him then. But he only needed to spend some time in Petersburg, among the set in which he moved, where people lived, really lived, instead of vegetating as in Moscow, and at once all these cares vanished and melted away like wax before a fire. His wife? Only that day he had been talking to Prince Chechensky. He had a wife and family with grown-up sons who were pages at court, and another family, an illegitimate one, in which there were other children. Though the first family was all right, Prince Chechensky felt happier with the second family. He took his eldest son to visit the second family, and told Oblonsky that he considered it developed his son and was good for him. What would they say to that in Moscow? Children? In Petersburg, children did not hinder their father's living. Children were brought up in educational establishments, and there were none of those barbaric views that were becoming so prevalent in Moscow. Lyovov's was a case in point, that the children should have every luxury and the parents nothing but work and worry. Here people understood that a man must live his own life like a civilized being. The service. Service, too, was not here that strained, hopeless drudgery that it was in Moscow. Here there was an interest in the service. Meeting the right person, a service rendered, a felicitous remark, the ability to perform certain tricks, made a man's career in a moment, as was the case with Bryantsov, whom Oblonsky had met the day before, and who was now a great dignitary. Service of that kind had an interest. But it was the Petersburg outlook on money matters that had a particularly soothing effect on Oblonsky. Bartnyansky, who spent at least 50,000 rubles a year at the rate he was living, had the day before made a notable remark to him on the point. As they were having a chat before dinner, Oblonsky had said to Bartnyansky, "You are, I think, intimate with Modvinsky. You could do me a good turn if you would put in a word for me. There is a post I should like to get. Member of the agency—" "Never mind the name, I shouldn't remember it. But why do you want to mix in those railway concerns with Jews?
Look at it how you like. It's horrid.
Oblonsky did not tell him that it was a live business, but Nyansky would not have understood that.
I am hard up. Have nothing to live on. But you do live?
Yes, but in debt.
Really? Is it much?
Asked Barton Yansky sympathetically.
Very much. About 20,000 rubles.
Barton Yansky burst into merry laughter.
Oh, you lucky fellow! He cried. My debts amount to 1.5 million, and I have nothing. But, as you see, I still find it possible to live.
Oblonsky knew this to be true, not only from hearsay, but from actual fact. Zviarkov, whose debts amounted to 300,000 rubles, didn't possess a penny, and yet he lived, and how he lived. Count Krivtsov, whose case had long been considered hopeless, still kept 2 mistresses. Petrovsky had run through 5 millions, continued living in just the same style, and even directed the finance department and received a salary of 20,000. But apart from that, Petersburg acted pleasantly on Oblonsky physically. It made him younger. In Moscow, he sometimes noticed some grey hairs, fell asleep after dinner, stretched himself, walked slowly upstairs, breathing heavily, felt dull among young women, and did not dance at balls. In Petersburg, he always felt that he had shaken off 10 years. In Petersburg, he felt what the 60-year-old Prince Pyotr Oblonsky, who had just returned from abroad, had described to him only the day before.
"Here, we don't know how to live," Pyotr Oblonsky had said. "Would you believe it, I spent the summer in Baden and really felt quite like a young man. I see a young woman, and my fancy, I dine, drink a little, and feel strong and full of spirits. I returned to Russia and had to be with my wife, and in the country besides, and in a fortnight I took to a dressing-gown and gave up dressing for dinner. And as to thinking about young women, why, I had turned into quite an old man. There was nothing left for me but to think of saving my soul. Then I went to Paris and again recovered."
Stepan experienced just the same difference as Pyotr Oblonsky. In Moscow, he let himself go to such an extent that, had he continued to live there long, he might even have come to the soul-saving stage. But in Petersburg, he again felt quite a smart fellow. Between the Princess Betsy Tverskaya and Oblonsky, there existed long-established and very peculiar relations. Oblonsky, in fun, always paid court to her, and told her the most indecent things, also in fun, knowing that she liked that more than anything. The day after his interview with Karenin, Oblonsky, calling on her, felt so youthful that he went accidentally to such lengths in this bantering courtship and humbug that he did not know how to get out of it, for unfortunately she was not merely unattractive, but actually repulsive to him. This tone had sprung up between them because he was very attractive to her, so he had been very pleased when the Princess Mayakaya turned up and put an end to their tête-à-tête.
"Ah, so you are here," she said on seeing him. "Well, how is your poor sister? Don't look at me like that," she added. "Since everyone has been attacking her, all those who are 100,000 times worse than she, I have thought she has acted splendidly."
"I can't forgive Vronsky for not letting me know when she was in Petersburg. I would have gone to her, and with her, everywhere. Please, give her my love. Well, tell me about her."
"Yes, her situation is a hard one," Oblonsky began, in the simplicity of his heart, taking the Princess Mayakaya's words for genuine coin when she said, "Tell me about her." But the Princess Mayakaya immediately interrupted him, as was her habit, and commenced telling her own tale.
"She has done what everybody, except myself, does secretly, and she would not deceive, and has acted splendidly. And the best thing she did was to leave that half-witted brother-in-law of yours. Excuse me. Everyone used to say, 'He is so clever, so clever.' I alone said that he was stupid. Now that he has got so chummy with Lydia Ivanovna and Landau, everyone says he is half-witted. And I should be glad not to agree with everybody, but this time I can't help it."
"But do explain to me what it means," said Oblonsky. Yesterday I called on him about my sister's affair and asked him for a definite answer. He did not give me an answer, but said he must think it over. And this morning, instead of an answer, I have received an invitation for this evening to go to the Countess